Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Hey, y'all, and welcome to Touchy Subjects Podcast, the podcast that aims to break the silence that tends to come with conversations around domestic and sexual violence. I'm Sean.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we're going to be discussing helping victims through the reporting process with our special guest, Detective Mercer. So thank you for joining us today, Detective.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, we are excited to have you on, especially because we know that when it comes to reporting a sexual assault, often one of those barriers can be, well, I don't know what's going to happen when I report, or I've heard that they might not have a good response when I do so, so I'm probably just not going to report it in the first place, because why would I do that if they're not going to listen? So I think it's a really important discussion to have, especially with you on today, so we can help kind of dispel some of the mystery of what's behind the curtain for these victims when they do choose to report.
Certainly.
Yes. But before we jump into the conversation, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah. So again, as you said, Detective Mercer, I am with the Saginaw Police Department out of the city. I have been with them for 6 years. I did a short stint on the road for just under 2 years, to where then I was fortunate enough to be promoted up to the Detective Bureau, where I currently still am.
Awesome. Well, I'm also sure, you know, being off the road for some things could be a little bit more, is a little little nicer.
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Yes, it can be at times, but the workload is very heavy. It's much more, I guess, at the road level. A lot of the guys like to say, you know what, I take the report, I don't have to worry about the extra work that it entails to obviously investigate after that part. So a lot more to it.
Gotcha. So for people who aren't super familiar with, like, just the different parts of law enforcement and things like that, what do you do as a detective that is like working with people who have been victimized?
Sure. So, I mean, I guess, and are we just talking victims in general? Are we, you know, sexual assault victims, or just, I mean, that, you know, it can be a little different, right? You know, and kind of what that looks
right.
like.
Yeah. But. So, I mean, just, like, in general, with, like, if somebody reports something, right, they've called 911 or their non-emergency number, and then a police officer shows up at their door or their place, whatever, and they tell that person what happens. Where then do you fit into that after that initial report has happened?
Sure. Yep. So, you know, and sometimes these reports can be initially taken or reported by you know, the hospitals as well. So okay. Sometimes, you know, the nurses have to call in, you know, domestic situations or, you know, sexual assault situations. So sometimes some of those calls are fielded right to central dispatch, where obviously we do have a covenant designated officer, a covenant officer that is, you know, primarily that's their whole job. They're there to be on standby 24/7 for any victim that were to walk in. So more than likely, that officer is going to take that report. And at that point, by the end of their shift, the supervisor, which is typically your sergeant, you know, they're fielding all these reports throughout the day. And basically at that level, they're going to send those reports up to the Detective Bureau. And then at that point, our detective sergeants, there's 8 of us, detectives upstairs, which seems like a lot to a lot of people, which it can be, but as many reports that we do see in the city, we do struggle at times to, you know, be able to treat every case 110%. But getting back to that, the detective sergeants are going to divvy up reports amongst us. And that's how they land on our desk, so to speak. You know, and not just amongst the assaults, but every day other reports as well. So and that's where that kind of starts the process with a detective.
Okay. I just think that it's maybe important for people to know that, like, if you call someone, the person who shows up at your door is probably not going to be the same person who's handling the rest of that investigation. Because, you know, that might throw people, like, you know, you see someone the one time, you've talked to them, and now you're talking to somebody completely different.
Sure. And, you know, with that being said, you know, you're right. And just to kind of go back to the venue of the hospital, even, you know, how many times these victims have to tell their story of what happened over and over is obviously traumatic in itself and can be very frustrating. By the time that you're speaking to an actual investigator that's going to be assigned to your case. But yes, it can be, like you said, that officer is just the initial report, and, you know, then you get assigned your detective and we reach out, you know, hopefully that same day, if not within 2 days, but we're very prompt about that process, cases as such. But obviously, you know, I can speak for myself as far as my reports. You know, I'm going to reach out to the victims. I'm going to prioritize those reports versus your, let's just say, a larceny report, you know, a stolen vehicle. Obviously, these reports are going to be priority on our desk. So when they do reach our desk, they're at the top of the list to be investigated as promptly as possible. And then you develop, you know, like I said, I'm going to reach out to my victim. I'm going to introduce myself and let them know that the contact that we're going to have, it's going to be just between, you know, them and I. Obviously, I want to get to know them personally. And sometimes that can be intimidating. I mean, obviously, you're the police. Some people's experiences have been good and have been bad. You know, does your victim think they're going to be believed? You know, you got a lot of barriers and things to kind of overcome. To build a rapport and that trust and that relationship through that whole process. So there's a lot of things that go into reports like this. You know, I've always said in my experience upstairs that I will personally say that sex crime reports, they can be, I can say in my experience, I will say they are probably worse than having a homicide, almost in some aspects, just with the legwork and how the things don't develop as quickly as you would want them to develop. And it does take time and DNA and all the things that we've got to do and sit down and take our time to make sure we get it right the first time. So they take a lot, not just out of obviously the victim having to tell their story again and again. You know, it can be very frustrating. And you know, at the same time, it's just as grueling and time consuming on our side as well. You know, it doesn't just stay at the office. You know, these are things that I have an hour drive home and I'm thinking about, did I miss something or what else that I've got to do? And just throughout the process of that case, of just constantly thinking about my victim, you know, are they okay? Do they feel safe? You know, there's just a lot of things that go into these cases that I don't think, obviously, in fairness, you know, people don't know what they don't know either, you know, so being able to kind of shed some light on that, a little background on that, that it does, it weighs heavy on you, especially when you get close to your victims and their families, you become part of their family.
And I think that time aspect too is so important for not just like general population people to understand, but also for victims to understand too, is that we see a lot of like shows like SVU where it's like, yeah, we get to see like the boom, 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 like, ah, end of the episode. We get to wrap it up and it's great. It's not how it works in real life. And in sometimes these things can take a long time.
Right.
And to a survivor, that can really feel like, well, they just don't care because this is taking absolutely so long. Then if they really cared about this, we would have got through this by now. When we just don't often see that other side of like, well, we're trying. It's just we either have a backlog. We have a lot of other cases that are very similar and we're trying to do all those cases at once. So it can be something that we just often overlook.
Right. Yeah. And with that, it is. It's And that's where you gotta remember as the investigator, and like I said, when you do have those relationships, that you stay very close or in touch with your victims and kind of already kind of prep them or explain that situation a little bit of, hey, you know, this isn't like TV. You do have to explain those things. There's search warrants you've got to type out and numerous search warrants for different things, right? You know, if we need to go seek evidence at the offender's place of residence or wherever the venue could be, whether it's a car, a home. I mean, there's so many different dynamics and a lot of paperwork that can go into that. And then collecting additional DNA, you know, you have to type search warrant after search warrant, and that takes time. And then tracking the individual down, if we hopefully know who they are as well, right? Sometimes we don't know, and that makes that process even harder. And then even so, when you do have in a perfect case, you know, you've got an offender and you have the victim and you have the DNA, now you've got to think about the other aspect of it is now we've got to get this testing done with the Michigan State Police Crime Lab, which is out of Bridgeport for us in Saginaw. Yeah. They have, I mean, their caseload is just, it's just as busy as we are, right? I mean, every agency in the area is constantly sending, whether it's cell phone data, whether it's DNA. I mean, all the things that you could possibly think of, these things get put in line, you know, and we don't have a lot of say in that, even though it is a pressing situation and it can be very frustrating. And then, you know, your victim at time, you know, they're going to lose hope and that you don't care, like you said, you know, and that becomes frustrating too, where you just got to kind of reel them back in and let them understand, you know, this is just part of the process. Don't think because there's this silence that nothing's happening. You know, it's just a slow moving process, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate that TV shows represent things the way that they do, you know, because you watch CSI and they'll swab someone's mouth and they walk it right on down over to the lab that's three doors down and they hand it to them and they're like, here you go. And then they run it like immediately. In a perfect world, that'd be great. We would all love to do that, right? But we don't all have Hollywood budgets in our counties and our cities to be able to have that much leeway with our staff.
Yeah, trust me, I would love to have that right there at my fingertips, right in our department. It would make things so much more easier.
Right. And that relationship aspect too is super important. So if you're a law enforcement officer listening to this, like, please keep in mind, like, the relationships are very vital. Like, as someone who was trained as a CNA, for example, I was told even if that person is not with it at all, explain everything that you're doing for that person. Explain, like, I'm going to turn you over because I need to reposition you. I need to do this, and explain why it's happening. Having that communication with the survivor, even if, like, you're like, this sucks, I don't want to tell them, like, I don't have any updates right now. Like, I want to give them good news. The silence is almost worse because they don't know that anything is happening. Where if you're willing to continually check in with the survivor and say, hey, I know we don't have any updates currently, but we are still working on processing it. Is there anything else I can do for you at this time? Like, giving them some of that power back to involve them in the process, let them know what is happening, just because that can help them understand at least that this is a process that is probably going to take longer than I want it to. Work is being done.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, not everybody understands the workload that we do have and we face every day on a regular basis, the cases that we see on our desk constantly. But again, I think it's important. I kind of try to treat it as how would I want to be treated, right? In a situation, if I was in that situation, can you make it as personal as possible? I think things of this nature shouldn't always be handled over the phone. I think it needs to be done in person. They need to see that you do care, right? And I'm not just, I don't know how to put it, but it's very hard to convey, I guess, or for that individual to see that you really do care. right? And I think that's important when that initial meeting that you have with the victim, that's going to be the everlasting impression I feel like when I meet them, right? Are they going to believe me that I'm going to do my job and I'm going to do everything I possibly can do for you? And I will, and I'll try to even do more. You know, you can't convey that, and you just can't. I mean, look at text messages and how they can be misconstrued, you know? But things of this nature, I think just kind of going back to just being more formal, you know, in person and constantly just let them know. I think the in-person checkups go, I would like to think, a lot further than a phone call, right? Or a text message, even though that's kind of how things are navigated, you know, nowadays. But, you know.
Right. Well, such a big part of communication is that body language that you can, like, actually share with someone while you're in that space. If somebody has a voice that is maybe just, like, monotone or something like that, that's all you're getting out of it. You're not getting any of that, oh, this person actually is involved. They just, their voice is XYZ thing. So being able to at least, like, especially in the beginning, have those person-to-person connections where you can build that rapport with someone. And I think it's important for the officer, and I think it's really important for the victim too, because they both need to be able to see each other, to just get that feeling of empathy for one another.
Absolutely. Oh, and you hit it right on the head, you know, and it can be very uncomfortable, you know, and I get the initial stage when you're probably dealing with a victim is going to be uncomfortable because it's going to be at the police department. And obviously those rooms and interrogation rooms, they're not comfortable. They're not cozy. But, you know, you hope that just in that moment that you can sit there and develop that relationship and let them know, you know, that you believe them, right? And but at the same time, as an investigator, you've got to wear the other hat too, but you got to be careful as how you wear that hat, because I don't want you to think, or my victim in front of me, that I don't believe you. But you have to understand that, you know, there's another side to things, that unfortunately we do have false reports, you know, that's a thing. And that angers us very much, because it takes away investigation time and resources to those that actually need it. But you know, again, that's a whole part of the process too, of meeting with people. You're gauging, and you're engaging with them and trying to read their body language, and you want to get their story, and you see the person really in their rawness. And a lot of the times I'm thanking them for telling me, you know, and feeling safe, number one. But again, who knows how many times have they already said their story over and over, and how many times do they need to keep saying it? You know, that takes a lot out of somebody. I'm there to listen. I want them to ask me as many questions as possible, and hey, put me on the spot. What is it you want me to do? Right? I know what I'm going to do. But you have a lot of say into what, you know, you would want, or what you would want to see done, right? And as soon as we meet with our victims there, we have a great team with a lot of resources literally at our fingertips. That's one thing I can say we have immediate, right? This isn't TV. They actually are down the hallway. Our victim service unit that we have, our team is amazing. They do exceptional work. They care like no other. You know, they're constantly in contact with us detectives, and which is important to have that relationship as well. They're following up with us. Hey, what's going on? Or, you know what? Maybe I just intercepted a case and I need resources, and I need one of them like ASAP. And let's say it's after hours. It doesn't matter. Those girls are on it. They don't care what time of the day, even if they want to, if we wanted them to respond to a scene for a victim, they're going to come out. They're amazing at what they do. Mm-hmm. And they have a passion like no other. And so I'm very pleased with our team that we have at the department and what they do. So, and again, that's got to be tough in itself.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of victims.
Love the victim service unit. They're great.
Yes.
I also want to highlight something that you said in there too for the listeners of how you do receive false reports. We know false reports exist. We know from like the advocacy perspective, if I'm looking at like statistics and data, we know that around 3 to 4% of all reports are going to end up being false. So to us, that number is like, okay, yes, obviously I'm just always going to believe a victim because I'll err on that side of caution. From a law enforcement perspective though, every report you're getting, you have to follow the, well, we have to figure out the whole story before we know one way or the other if this is a true or false situation. And I think the important thing that you said in there was, I'm still going to believe this person. Because even if that is a false report, knowing that that number is usually going to be low, it is more important to treat all of those reports as if they were true. And then finding out later that they were false instead of initially disbelieving this victim until you have all of the information present to you.
Right. You know, and we can deal with the consequences of that, right? I mean, there's silly things people lie about, you know, whether it's getting back at somebody, retaliation, and, you know, is it more of a informational, let's explain, you know, and why we shouldn't do these things. And, you know, it is a felony, you know, to report something that's false. That's a big deal. And, you know, sometimes we have repeat offenders, unfortunately, and they're going to deal with the consequences, unfortunately. You know, the conversation in the initial stage, we explain these things, this is what this could look like. But, you know, we've got to look at both sides. And like I said, you know, there's a lot of hats to be worn, and we're not here just to put people in jail. That's not what we like to do. You know, that's not the fun part of the job. The job is not even, you could say, I mean, with the things that we see on a regular basis, it's sad, you know, it's heavy. It's real.
Yeah. When I'm, you know, doing an orientation or training with a new advocate, I, you know, as advocates, our job is to believe, right? That's what we do as DV and SA advocates. We just believe everybody that comes in. And I tell them there are other people whose job it is to figure out all the logistics of what happened. So in a sense, in that way, like, being an advocate is so much easier because, like, we know we don't have to do that investigative piece, and we can just be supportive to the victim. So just so you know, like, we're out there, we're telling people, you know, that unfortunately, like, it's a hard job for the investigators to do. They don't want to have to ask the same questions over and over again because they have to try and get to the bottom of something. They don't want to ever feel like they're not believing a victim. But then in the same thing, like, you have to prove that someone's guilty because that's the way the law works. Like, they're innocent until proven guilty. So you guys just have a really tough job. And I just want people to know that it's hard.
It is, and it can be very frustrating, too, when, you know, you may just not have the evidence that you need, right? Mm-hmm. But you know this happened. You know it absolutely happened. So I always encourage victims, go to the hospital, get checked out. Even if you did go home and you showered, there can still be, you know, injury, okay? Even if you did launder the clothes, hold on to those clothes that you were wearing. Put them aside. Just these little things that can go a long way, but it doesn't also mean that, you know, DNA or trace evidence could not be there either. But I will say it is very important. You are a victim, to please go to the hospital, get checked out. Mm-hmm. That's the initial starting stage that helps investigators as well as our case. Mm-hmm. Our case that we're going to have, that's step one.
Yeah. Or a sexual assault center.
Yeah. Absolutely.
With a sane nurse, they can do all of those things too. If you are feeling like, you know what, I don't want to go to the hospital because I know I'm going to sit in that emergency room waiting room and I'm going to see every single person that I went to high school with. They're all going to be circling through there with their sick kids and blah, blah, blah. Call a sexual assault center. There's one in almost every county. I mean, I don't know if there's, I'm sure there's counties out there that don't have one, but every county that I can think of right now has a sexual assault center. So give them a call because they probably have, you know, even maybe like an exam room in their office or a special place where you can go where it's a little more private, a little more secluded, and you can meet with an officer there where you don't have to sit in an interrogation room to do that initial report. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's places out there that are really trying to make this a little bit more comfortable and a little more accommodating for victims. You just have to make the step to go to those places.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
So to take this conversation kind of to that like next step for us, so we're kind of talking about like that data, that that specimen collection and all that stuff. So let's kind of just like take it back to a full like full picture view. When somebody wants to go through that initial report, so someone has been sexually assaulted, they want to report it. What does that look like for them?
Sure. So ideally in a perfect world, I mean, like I said, you know, we're going to encourage that every individual be checked out.
Yep.
Please try to remember, you know, and not all cases you'll be able to remember, but like I said, with the clothing, you know, that's where the DNA and trace evidence is going to start, right? That's where I'm going to as an investigator. Okay. Did you go get checked out, right? Because we're going to need a kit. It's going to be very important for the investigation. Clothing. Do we have clothing, right? Do you know your perpetrator? Great if you do. And if you don't, hopefully we can get a description, an idea. We'll hopefully be able to figure it out. But I will, you know, obviously I'm going to need to meet with my victim and in the investigation room just to have it properly documented, which obviously could feel, like I said, it can be cold. It can feel unwelcoming. But when we get to that stage, there's going to be uncomfortable questions, unfortunately, again, that are going to have to be asked by us. Mm-hmm. And it's not because we want to humiliate anybody or make them feel we don't believe them. Sometimes it's really the questions are dumbed down so much that how do I say this? The questions that we're going to ask are obviously going to be very intrusive. And they have to be asked in a way that are, they need to be very descriptive and uncomfortable, more than likely for the victim. And you know what? Thinking about, you know, whether an agency has maybe a female investigator, if you don't have that dynamic even, and you're just dealing with a male. Now, I could only imagine if that were me sitting in front of that male investigator to have to sit here and tell him all these uncomfortable things, number one, is going to be hard to overcome. You know, luckily, you know, we have a couple of female investigators in our agency. And there's times where we have males where I'm like, you know what? It's probably going to be uncomfortable for him to maybe disclose things to me. Maybe he'll feel more comfortable with a male investigator, right? So you've got this other part of the dynamic too, where you've got to be aware and not take it personal too, where, you know, they don't want to talk to you, right? I don't feel comfortable talking to you. Well, don't take it personal, right? It's okay. Well, maybe you'll feel comfortable with a male investigator or a female investigator, and we can try to, you know, navigate it that way. But, you know, those questions are going to have to be asked. And it's, again, like, I think it just all comes back to communicating with the individual across from you and saying, hey, I'm not trying to embarrass you, but I'm going to have to ask these uncomfortable questions, and they're going to have to be in detail. And yeah, you might not remember exactly, and that's okay right now, because there's going to be things that probably come to you later that I'm going to need to know. And you know what? If they do, jot it down or make a note in your phone, whatever it is that you utilize. Just when you do remember something, set it aside and contact us. Let us know, because that does happen. But, you know, in that part, I mean, we're gathering a whole bunch of information that we have to ask, that we know just through our process that we're going to need for the DNA and the trace evidence. But I'm going to also explain, you know, I've got to get your DNA as well, you know, from the victim. And then I've got to go and, you know, collect all this other DNA, and hopefully I can get their clothing. And then I'm going to have their clothing, you know, tested at the lab. You know, and then at that point, it's kind of where you get to that silence part.
Yeah.
The part that we all hate. It really do hate. But again, I think as an investigator, I think it's important. That's where you kind of bridge that gap there, and stay in contact more frequent during that time to let them know, hey, I haven't forgotten about you. Okay. I just haven't heard anything yet. I don't have lab results yet. Right.
Right.
Just communicate.
Yeah. And not to cut you off here real quick, but I want the recognizing that the questions that are being asked by law enforcement might sound a bit more intrusive, especially to a survivor, or sometimes, depending on how the interviewer is phrasing them, may come off sounding victim blamey. Understanding that, one, it can be hard to sometimes find the right language to use, but so not trying to justify the use of like victim blaming language, but know that they're asking these questions specifically because they are trying to get some information out of them. So that way they can build the full picture that they need to help understand everything that happened and what was going on. It was one of the harder things for me to also like wrap my head around when I first started doing the work that I do, being more of like an advocate, where, yeah, I don't want victims at any point during this process to feel blamed for what they've experienced. I don't want victims to feel at any point that they're not being heard or listened to by the law enforcement that's interviewing them. But they only have so much leeway on what questions you can ask and how you can ask them before they start, you know, maybe sounding like leading questions. Or questions that, yeah. So it can just be difficult to understand. Know that as long as that law enforcement officer or that detective or the interviewer is acting in good faith and putting in the effort, it goes a long way.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I mean, who's to say this isn't the investigator's first case that they've ever had? Mm-hmm. You know, not to say that they don't have the resources or tools to navigate correctly, but it can also be an uncomfortable situation maybe for that individual too. You know, I mean, be a lot of firsts as an investigator. I mean, you're constantly thinking of all the things. Did I do the right thing? Did I ask the right question? Because right now you don't want your victim to have to be asked any further questions. So you're kind of trying to like put this all together so quickly. With not making them feel, and again, some people just don't have that, how do you say it politely? I guess the delivery, and how, you know, maybe they're asking the questions, the delivery can be putting, right?
Might be a little bit less tactful.
Right, like, we can talk about, like, how a doctor's bedside manner is,
right?
So it's kind of the same thing, right? That doctor might be amazing at what they do,
right?
But they might not have the skill to be able to kind of talk to the patient when they're in a shitty situation, right?
Right. Well, so I feel like, you know, I've been in just, I feel like sometimes you feel like, oh, it's, take your ticket, right? You're in line. I've been in those situations. I mean, not this type of situation, but like how that could feel is that, oh, okay, well, tell me your story, or just being so blunt and just so just distant and cold, and you know, their delivery and demeanor is just completely off-putting, where you're like, okay, well, why did I even come in here? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like I'm just, oh, here's my ticket, and then they've got the next 49 people to see behind me. Why am I, you know, any different? Why should I feel you're going to handle this, you know? But, yeah, I mean, some people just can't communicate well, and that doesn't mean that we don't not care. But yeah, I mean, sometimes that is a thing. I've seen it where it's like, okay, that was just a little distasteful. Okay. Like, you got to know your audience, I guess, is what I'm saying. Right. Be aware all the time. And that's, you know, I guess you could say now being a little bit more of a senior detective up there. You know, I'm fortunate enough that, you know, I do have a lot of guys and gals that will ask for my input, right? Which is good. I mean, we're constantly learning too. Law changes all the time, yeah. You know? So it's not it's not easy being on this side all the time. We develop really close relationships with our prosecutors, you know, and at times they can flood us with a laundry list so long. For a case such as this, like I said, and you're dealing with a whole bunch of other cases, and you got this going on, the prosecutor's wanting you to do this, and you're trying to remember all these things, and it just never stops.
So let's look at, we've gone through the lull period where we've kept in great contact with our survivor, so they know that we are still working with them. It's just taking the lab a while to get back to us with all of the data, like all the like tests and everything. We got the information back now. So what is this process then going to look like for that survivor?
Sure. So a lot of the data that comes back from the lab, that's really shared between, I guess you'd say, the prosecutor and myself at that point, because there's just a lot of, and let's be real, I mean, half the language on that paper, I'm like, can you dumb me this down? All I can see is I've got a quintillion amount more likely that it's contributor from this person, right? And I'm like, okay, that's great. That's a number. But, you know, we kind of fumble through the language, right? Even at times, I'll call the scientist or lab individual back and be like, hey, girl, I need you to break this down. All right? Like, I'm just a cop here. All right? And so they're like, in half the time they laugh. But as far as that, we're kind of sharing the results, so to speak. We're trying to figure out at that point whether it's good or bad results. How do we navigate the case? Are we going to have enough or not enough to go to court, you know, and present this case, where it favors our victim, or, you know, the offender? Do we offer a plea deal? Because we might not have what we were expecting to come back. It's not that we want to give the plea deal, right? That's something I'm just like, no, we're going. But sometimes in the situations when you just don't have a good deck of cards in your hand, which is very frustrating, I can say, to me, because of the time, the effort that's put in, not just mine, but the prosecutors as well. You know, we're trying to navigate this. Do we relook at the evidence? Did we miss something? Is there something else we should have tested? Do we have enough of the DNA left to test? Because at some point, you got to be very strategic about what you're requesting, because you only have so much of that individual's DNA. Not to say you probably couldn't get more. However, there's a lot of restrictions with the lab and what is tested and what they, you know, what they will test. So there's a lot of factors that go into it where you're just like, but yeah, we're kind of just, I guess they say playing tennis, you know, we're going back and forth with each other on you know, if we have the perfect case, it's like, okay, that's what we needed. That's a slam dunk. We're going. So then what we're going to do is we're going to get with our victim. We're going to all come together at the prosecutor's office. We're going to share those results, whether at some point, whether it is good or bad. And we're going to present, hey, this is what we have or what we don't have. Ideally, in a perfect world, yeah, we're going to go to court. We have everything. But then that's where we're going to sit there and we're not only is the victim going to be prepped for trial, you know, certain questions and what they can expect the prosecutor to ask them. And again, you know, representation, what they might cross you on to kind of prepare you. I mean, you can't prepare everyone in a perfect setting as to what they're going to ask. But again, they have a job to do to try to help out their client. But yeah, so I mean, prime example is, I mean, tomorrow I've got to go in and sit down with the prosecutor and the victim. We're going to go over our case for next week. That's going to trial. So that's great. I'm excited for it. I hope they are, but you're also nervous too, you know, because ultimately you don't have the say. It's going to be the jury. But we hope that we have a strong enough case to present and execute it really well. You know, and that's a whole nother process of, you know, having the victim who will fully cooperate all the way to the end. You know, sometimes they don't want to sit up there in the box across from their offender again and see them. Totally understandable. Totally get it. But then that's sometimes where you're asking your victim, hey, what do you want to do? Do you want to try to do this charge and do a plea? Or do you want to go for it? And that means, you know, we all got to be players in this game.
That, I think, might be something that, at least from a general population sense, looking inward on these cases can be really difficult to understand. Like, when they accept that plea deal, they're like, well, how did they get a plea? Like, why did they get so low when they did this thing? And sometimes that's because maybe that's what the survivor wanted. Maybe the survivor didn't want to go through with the whole process because they didn't want to be re-traumatized by having to testify against this person. Maybe right. they were genuinely worried about what might happen to them if they did, so they just didn't want to. Or they do genuinely still care for this person and they don't want them put away forever. There can be a variety of reasons why a survivor might choose to go through the plea deal route instead of like the let's go to court, let's get them. And that can be hard for people to looking in understand, is that this might have been law enforcement absolutely listening to the survivor and doing what the survivor wanted and what was going to be best for them in this moment instead of what we think was going to be best, which is putting them away.
Yeah. And obviously we want to get something versus nothing, because if we're going to go for it all and we know our cards aren't showing the best cards, not to say we don't have evidence, but you got to remember, you've got 12 jurors that are going to make that decision. Mm-hmm. Now, do we go for something we know we can get on a plea? And I'm not saying that's the route we want to take, but those are the cards sometimes we're dealt just because of the missing evidence and the things that we don't have, you know? And I think that's an opportunity that a lot of people don't see behind scenes, that we just don't have a good set of cards in front of us, but we have enough for this, right? Now, do we risk it all? We're going to be behind you 110% to say, let's go. Let's do it. Let's give it a shot. But the end of the day, I'm probably going to be just as frustrated when, you know, those 12 jurors say maybe not guilty. Ugh. Now we got nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other piece of it too, is that a plea might be something. Or when people are like, well, why did they get tried in a civil case versus like a criminal case? It's like, well, sometimes that might, the standard you need to prove a civil case versus a like legal case is very, like criminal case is very different. So maybe the evidence wasn't fully there for what you needed to know you were going to put this person away. But it's more likely than not that it happened. So maybe they can go the civil route and at least get that survivor something in some form of justice, which, like we said, is better than going to be nothing.
Right. And again, like I said, like, that's the toughest pill to swallow sometimes when you're right there and you're like, son of a gun. Yeah. Like, we just don't have enough to just, you know. So, and I think that's where you see a lot of people are like, well, how did he or how'd she only get that? Yeah. You know, and that's that behind the scenes where we can't share with everybody, obviously, you know, what's going on. But yeah, it's a lot of navigating behind the scenes that's going on that we're trying to get what we can out of the situation. But, and that's why I say, you know, from the beginning, it's so important just, you know, getting checked out and just remembering just little things and key things and, you know, the clothing and thinking, you know, when you watch these shows, like DNA, it's DNA. DNA does not lie, you know, and so many things. I mean, God, we shed skin cells all the time where we transfer to one another, you know, and there's just so many things where you could explain to somebody as to why maybe his or her DNA would be there. You know, is it a roommate? Okay. So there's a lot of difference in dynamics where, it's just a very hard game, and it's not the answers that you're going to want to hear from us because, you know, let's say your perpetrator was living with you. Okay. Well, of course his or her DNA is going to be there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do we go somewhere else with that to prove what actually happened? So it's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah. Right. Or sometimes, you know, we have perpetrators who are people that someone has had consensual sex with before. And so now we're looking at, well, sure, the DNA is there, but is it there non-consensually this time? And those are all really hard things to prove. That doesn't mean don't report them, because you absolutely should still report them. But it's just, it's another layer to think about when maybe the outcomes aren't exactly what you were hoping for.
And like you said, I mean that's a very tough one to navigate. It just, again, there's a lot of layers to it that you got to peel back and try to get to overcome. And like I said, these cases to me are probably the toughest that I deal with. But again, just want them to know that, you know, we do care. We genuinely care. You know, it might not seem like it. You may have an investigator that's off-putting and cold. Or maybe, who knows? I mean, maybe he looks like he's new and green out the chute, you know, and you've got a 40-year-old victim and you're like, oh my God, what is this kid gonna do for me? Oh my God, even know, I mean, he hasn't even experienced life yet, you know. Just trust the process.
Well, like
knowing that person has support from senior officers and supervisors and things like that to help them through, but they're never gonna get, you know, to the point where they just know everything unless they go through it. So you got to work with them.
Yeah. Right.
Unfortunately, absolutely. Everyone has a first case that they're going to work. And that's where you have those senior detectives who you can rely on to make sure, like, hey, I don't want to fuck this up. Help me through this to make sure that I get the best outcomes for the survivor. And that can be hard for some people too, is like asking like for help. When they're like, no, I should know how to do this. It's okay to not know everything.
Yeah. I think a lot of us, when you first come in, you're like, you're overwhelmed because you're like, oh my God, I don't want to mess up. I don't know everything. And, you know, I'd rather somebody sit there and say, I don't know. But you know what? I can guarantee you they're asking the questions. They're wanting to sit in the interviews. And they're going to trainings. And they're very active in their trainings. But I can always say there's never not one of us that's watching an interview going on. They're always monitored by another investigator. Obviously, for a good reason, you don't want multiple people in an interview like this. That's overwhelming. And number one, you're already in front of an officer, whether you've had good experience or bad. To add another and another in a room, that's, you know, that's a bit much. But we are watching the monitors and making sure things are going accordingly, you know. So, and yeah, when there's times where they step out of the room, they're probably asking those questions. Hey, did I forget something? Or, you know what, I'm jotting notes watching the interview to make sure you ask these questions that you're not going to remember. I mean, yeah, you're on the spot in there, you know. I'm not saying you're winging it, but there's a lot to cover in a short amount of time, you know. You don't have enough hours in the day.
Yeah. The amount of times I forget things in presentations I've done hundreds of times is pretty high. So I can imagine somebody who is trying to make sure that they're doing the best they can to help somebody while they've reported something that is already, we know, underreported. Like, I can imagine that's a bit of a stressful environment and they're going to forget a thing or two.
Right. Absolutely.
So thank you for joining us today, Detective. We are getting close to our hour mark, so I wanted to make sure we're cognizant of your time. So before we sign out here, what would you want victims to know the most about when it comes to reporting and when it comes to working with law enforcement?
Right. Please just report it. Right. That's the first step. Secondly, please go to your local hospital. Get checked out. Even if it has been several days, doesn't matter. Yes, the body is a beautiful thing and can heal rather quickly. But sometimes there could still be some trace evidence to work with. Clothing, DNA, you know, those things are crucial in our investigations with this. Yeah, in a perfect world, we know the perpetrator. Yeah, that's what I would say. Always report, try to please trust the process, have patience with us. You know, we don't have control of the whole, you know, investigation. There's a lot of people involved in it, and as there should be, it's very important that, you know, we get it right the first time. But don't ever hesitate to report something.
And then if somebody is in law enforcement and they are listening to this, what would you like them to know about working with victims?
Really? Jeez.
I like to ask the easy questions at the end. Don't worry.
Yeah. I mean, you could have prepped me a little bit. What I would want them to know working with victims, you know, be patient. Just listen. Let them talk. And if they don't, that's okay too. Maybe it's just not the right time. Ask for help. Maybe you are, you know, new. Maybe this is your first case you're experiencing. Just try to be cognizant of in knowing your audience too. You know, you have a victim that's come to you that's gone through something very tragic, right? But they're a survivor too, right? But yeah, just don't be so, I guess, number one, don't be judgmental, right? They're already thinking they're not going to believe, you know, we're not going to believe them. But just hear them out, take the time, be patient, and just do your due diligence. That's why we're here. Mm-hmm. These cases are very important, and they should be treated as that.
Yeah. And then if I could just add in too, also don't be just so focused on the work that you lose the human aspect of it.
Right.
Because you are working with someone who has experienced something really, really difficult for them. And yes, it can be hard when you're so focused, like, I have to do this. I have to do this because I want to get the best outcomes for this person. But if you're not hearing what this victim is saying to you during that process, you're missing a piece that can be more helpful in the long run for this victim than you just bulleting through the case to try to get to the end.
Right. And, you know, one thing we didn't touch on, too, if I could just slightly just kind of put in here.
Yeah, for sure.
Victims that can't even speak for themselves, or, you know, kiddos. As a parent, hear them out. Again, do the same things that I've said before. Go get them checked out. We're going to get the report. We're going to set up a CAN interview, which is a very friendly interview. You know, we're going to treat it the same way. But again, just listen to the kiddos and just get them checked out. We'll do the rest from there. But that's the first step.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Detective Mercer. Very sorry for asking you a difficult question right at the end, you know, but.
Sure you are. A lot of have.
Well, again, thank you so much.
I really do. I had a great time. I'm glad you guys asked me on. You know, hopefully this helps a little bit or reaches some of the victims.
Well,
all I want out of it.
Yeah. And we are very glad to have you not only working, you know, in the city that I work in, but also just for being willing to join us to help kind of demystify some of this for survivors, because we know this can be really difficult for them. So I just wanted to thank you again. And before we sign out, are there any socials or anything that you want to throw out to the audience? If the answer is no, that's fine.
And no.
No, no worries. I just always like to ask. So thank you again, and thank you all for listening today. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and LinkedIn at Touchy Subs Pod to keep up to date when we have new episodes and other content going out. Please email us any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com. And please rate and follow us on your favorite podcast listening app. It really helps the show out.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.